If you would, turn to 1 Samuel chapter 4. 1 Samuel chapter 4, there we go. I want to read verse 21. 1 Samuel chapter 4 and verse 21 says, "Then she named the child Ichabod, saying, 'The glory has departed from Israel, because the ark of God has been captured, and because of her father-in-law and her husband.'" And so she says, the glory of the Lord has been departed, and she's named her son Ichabod, which means no glory. Ichabod is not a familiar name, except in a work of fiction where a man by the name of Ichabod Crane has to deal with a headless horseman. And even more than that, it's not a familiar name to us who are Bible students. The name Ichabod occurs just one time, and just kind of in passing at the end of a story. But we're going to talk about Ichabod's story tonight, what it is that led him to be named Ichabod. You know, people named back in those times named their children typically something that had to do with either a characteristic of that child or a circumstance that was going on when that child was born, or named after someone in the family that was dearly beloved and they wanted to be remembered. So names meant something back then. And she names her son knowing full well what the word Ichabod means. It meant no glory. So his name comes up at the end of a story that ushers in one of the really watershed moments for the children of Israel, when Samuel begins to exert his presence on the children of Israel. And just before Israel ceases to be ruled by judges and begins to be ruled by an earthly king, there are four significant bad things that happened that led to this infant being named Ichabod. Number one, Israel's army had been routed. Number two, two of Israel's prominent priests had been slain. Number three, the high priest, Eli, had lost his life. And number four, the Ark of the Covenant had been taken captive by the Philistines. What is it that caused all of this to happen? Well, as we are introduced to the story, we are told that Eli's two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, are wicked men. They are priests of God, but they are abusing their position as priest. And they are stealing from the people. They're taking what they have no right to take, and they're practicing all kinds of immorality and indecency, taking advantage of the place that they have in God's system. And because of that, in 1 Samuel chapter 3 and verse 11, 1 Samuel 3 and verse 11, the Lord speaks to young Samuel, and he says to him, "Behold, I will do something in Israel, at which both ears of everyone who hears it will tingle. In that day I will perform against Eli all that I have spoken concerning his house from beginning to end. For I have told him that I will judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knows, because his sons made themselves vile, and he did not restrain them. And therefore I have sworn in the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be atoned for by sacrifice or offering forever." And so the Lord says, "I've had enough of these two young men and their wickedness, their vileness. And I've had enough of you, Eli, not correcting your son." We talked this morning about training up a child in the way that he should go. Eli has done an awfully pitiful job of that. He has not trained his sons. He has not corrected them. He has not called them into account for the kind of things that they are doing. And so the Lord says, that's enough of that. And His promise is that He is going to do to Eli's house exactly what He had told Eli before that He was going to do, because Eli knew what his sons were doing, and yet he did not keep them from doing that. He says, I'm going to judge Eli's house. And that word judge there in that statement doesn't mean that he's going to take an account of Eli's house. It means he has condemned Eli's house. And they are going to suffer the results of that condemnation. And the Lord decides to do that by taking Israel to battle. In chapter 4, verses 1 and 2, passage says, and the word of Samuel came to all Israel. Now Israel went out to battle against the Philistines and encamped beside Ebenezer. And the Philistines encamped at Aphek. Then the Philistines put themselves in the battle array against Israel. And when they joined battle, Israel was defeated by the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men of the army in the field. And so Israel goes out against what had become really their arch enemy. And they are whipped by this arch enemy. 4,000 of Israel lose their lives. And it is devastating to the children of Israel. They were not used to losing battles. They were used to God being with them and them winning the battle. And yet here is a battle that they lose. And they lost it. And they lost 4,000 of their soldiers because of the wickedness of two men and because of a father who allowed them to be wicked. Now imagine that. Think of the destruction that came here on this occasion because of the actions of just a few people. And that's certainly not something that is unique in the history of man or in the history of Israel. Very early on in Israel's conquering of the land, they lost another battle in the city of Ai, the next town after Jericho. They had that wonderful victory in Jericho. And then they go to Ai, and they're filled with confidence because God gave them victory over this great walled city. And if they can have victory over this great walled city, really kind of without firing a shot, then what is little old Ai? But Ai whips them. And they wonder why that is. And God tells them, it's because of the sin of one man. One man did something that God said not to do. He took from the spoils of Jericho. He took those things, he hid them in his tent, and no one knew except Achan and God. And because of Achan's folly and his sin, God caused the children of Israel to lose on that day as well. And if you read in the book of 2 Samuel, you'll see a number of occasions when David's sin caused harm to Israel. And David's sin with Bathsheba, His kingdom was never the same. And the children of Israel, who had under David's leadership won victory after victory after victory after victory, and their borders were spreading, and it was a wonderful thing. And then comes David's sin. And his kingdom was never the same again. And then toward the end of his rule, when he decides to violate the will of God and number the people, and a great destruction comes on the people at that time in the form of a plague. Because of the sin of one man, because one man had done something wrong, how many can be harmed by the sinfulness of only one. And so we have a passage like 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 6 and 7, which explains why we are to practice discipline against those who refuse to be what God demands that we be. And we know that, why it is that we have to take note of that and practice discipline against that person, not only for their good, but he says there in 1 Corinthians 5, verses 6 and 7, your glorying is not good. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? Therefore, purge out the old leaven, that you may be a new lump, since you truly are unleavened. He said, God has an expectation of you, and that expectation is unleavenedness, that is sinlessness, purity. And yet you have sin among you. And in order to spare the many, you must deal with the one. And so it is on this occasion, a few make the many suffer. What is wrong with just letting things slide? What is wrong with not taking action when just a few are doing that which is wrong? The problem with that is a little leaven leavens the whole lump. And so Israel suffered a defeat. And at this point, Israel's elders make a decision that would multiply their agony and seal the fate of Eli's family. In 1 Samuel chapter 4 and verse 3, it says, when the people had come into the camp, the elders of Israel said, why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Let us bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord from Shiloh to us, that when it comes among us, it may save us from the hand of our enemies. And so they have a plan here. We've been defeated by the Philistines. And the reason for that is obviously because the Ark of the Covenant is not with us. The God's glory in that Ark is not with us. And so we'll correct that situation. We'll go out. We'll call to Shiloh. Shiloh's only a few miles away, and that's where the Ark of the Covenant is. We'll send to Shiloh for the Ark of the Covenant. And so they do that. And the two priests, Hophni and Phinehas, go with it. In verse 5 it says, when the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel shouted so loudly that the earth shook. Imagine that. Such a shout of joy and confidence, because the Ark of the Covenant is with us. And if the Ark of the Covenant is with us, then all of our problems are solved. Did you notice back up there in verse 3, at the last part of verse 3? That when it comes among us, it may save us from the hand of our enemies. I'll tell you what's going to save us from the Philistines. It is the Ark of the Covenant. Oh, how wrong they were. What were they thinking in bringing the Ark to the battlefield? Well, whatever it was, it exposed a common misunderstanding among the people of God about what is involved in the presence of God with us. Their reasoning seemed to be based on sound principle. And that is that true success requires divine favor. If you don't have God's favor, then you're not going to be successful. And that was the whole basis for bringing the Ark of the Covenant up to the battle. The Ark of the Covenant ensures God's favor for us. And there's a lot of Bible to back that up. The blessing of the Lord makes one rich. The wise man says in Proverbs 10 and verse 22, unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. Unless the Lord guards the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. You see, there's a lot of good reason to say that we need God's favor with us. And if God's favor is with us, then we can do those things that will cause us to be victorious. But if God's favor is not with us, then we'll be defeated in what we do. Philippians 4 and verse 13, the Apostle Paul, it is kind of on that principle of true success requires divine favor that he is able to say, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. You see, Paul understood this principle. He's not saying there that I am so great, I am so powerful, I am so spiritually strong that I can just do anything. What he's saying is, Christ with me, the divine favor with me is going to give me success in whatever I do that the Lord would have me to do. True success requires divine favor, and these people understood that. What they didn't understand is that divine favor is given only to those who are faithful. The psalmist said in Psalm chapter 5, verses 11 and 12, but let all those rejoice who put their trust in you, that is in God. Why? Verse 12, for you, O Lord, will bless the righteous. With favor, you will surround him as with a shield. Who is it that the Lord has promised to surround with his shield? Who is it that the Lord has promised to favor in whatever it is that they strive to do? It is the person who is righteous, who is the person who puts their trust in God. Proverbs 12 and verse 2, a good man obtains favor from the Lord, but a man of wicked intentions, he will condemn. These people understood we need divine favor. What they fail to understand is divine favor comes not from having a good luck charm with you. Divine favor comes by doing the will of God. 1 Timothy chapter 3, or 2 John verse 9 first, says, whoever transgresses and does not abide in the doctrine of Christ does not have God. Whoever abides in the doctrine of Christ has both the Father and the Son. The same principle that is true back there in Psalms and Proverbs is true in the New Testament as well. Divine favor is given only to those who abide now in the doctrine of Jesus Christ. And so we have 2 Timothy chapter 3, verses 2 through 5, where he talks about the wickedness of men. Men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. And he says these kinds of men have a form of godliness, but they deny its power. That's what we're finding there in 1 Samuel chapter 4. Men who have an appearance, a form of godliness, but they fail to understand what real godly power is all about. There are people who mistake the symbols for the reality and who come to trust the symbol. They're the kind of people who bring up a symbol of God's presence without regard to whether God is present in the symbol. Someone has rightly said that they looked for deliverance from the ark of the Lord rather than the Lord of the ark. I think that's so very true. They didn't understand what the presence of the Lord meant. They didn't understand what it was or who it was that would result in their salvation. Not a golden box, but the Lord himself. And if the Lord wasn't in the box, then the Lord was not going to be with them. And the fact of the matter is, the Lord had left them a long time before this. Because of their wickedness and because of the wickedness of these two men. Because their father had not restrained them. And so they are defeated once again. But notice the Philistines in verse 7. It says, "So the Philistines were afraid, for they said, 'God has come into the camp.' And they said, 'Woe to us, for such a thing has never happened before. Woe to us, who will deliver us from the hand of these mighty gods?'" These are the gods who struck the Egyptians with all the plagues in the wilderness. I like that. You know, here comes the Ark of the Covenant, and here's this rejoicing of the people of Israel, the army of Israel, and it's making the ground shake. And the Philistines look, and they know exactly what's going on here. They know that the magic box is there. And they know that the God who is behind that box must be in the camp with the children of Israel. That must be why they are rejoicing. And they are scared to death at that. Scared to death at the idea that now we have not just a battle against these people, but a battle against these people and their God. Wouldn't it be nice if everyone not right with God had that attitude? Wouldn't it be nice if those in the Lord's church who are not right with God had that kind of an attitude? Woe is us! Because the Lord is present. I'll tell you what's missing in the world today. It is the truth behind Psalm chapter 99 and verse 1. The Lord reigns. Let the people tremble. People don't tremble at God anymore. I'll tell you what's wrong in the Lord's church today. People don't tremble. A lot of folks don't tremble in fear of God. "My flesh trembles," says David, "for fear of you." Here's a man who was righteous. Here's a man who is giving this entire chapter over to how much he loves the Lord and the word of the Lord and how it is his guide. And yet the idea of being in the presence of God causes him to tremble. "My flesh trembles for fear of you." "God is here," said the God ungodly. "Woe to us." I tell you, we need more of that kind of attitude. But notice in verse 9, rather than just turning tail and running, just totally giving up, Philistine said, "We've got to do something about this, and what we need to do is determine even more strongly that we're going to get out there and we're going to battle with all that we've got." They say to themselves, the Philistines do in verse 9, "Be strong and conduct yourselves like men, you Philistines, that you do not become servants of the Hebrews as they have been to you. Conduct yourselves like men and fight." Isn't it interesting how sometimes the wicked become an example for us? How they become an example of how we ought to deal with the battle that we are fighting? They didn't give up. When they saw that the going was going to be even more difficult than it had been before, and there was a possibility that they might lose, they became even stronger. They said, "We've got to fight better. We've got to be more diligent." Oh, that God's people would have that attitude in the battle that we are fighting against this world. Oh, that we were always that committed to our fight. We could always say, "I would rather die on the battlefield than become a slave to the enemy." And so the big battle is waged. And sure enough, the symbol was there, but God wasn't there. In verse 10, so the Philistines fought and Israel was defeated. And every man fled to his tent. There was a very great slaughter, and there fell of Israel 30,000 foot soldiers. What a horrible scene that is. Before it was only 4,000 of the army of God. Now it is 30,000 men of the army of God fall in this battle. And even more, verse 11, also the ark of God was captured, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. You see, the symbol was there, but God wasn't. And when God wasn't with Israel, they became as weak or weaker than every nation around them. And so they lost, and they lost mightily. And then in verses 12 through 18, a messenger comes to Eli. You can imagine the feeling that Eli has as the army is out there and they've already been defeated once, and his two sons are out there, and he knows what God has said in condemning his sons, and the Ark of the Covenant is out there. You can imagine what he was feeling at this time, this 98-year-old man. And here comes a messenger. And the messenger is covered in dust. The townspeople know what that means. And Eli, I think, knows what that means. And so in verse 16 it says, then the man said to Eli, I am he who came from the battle, and I fled today from the battle line. And he said, what happened, my son? So the messenger answered and said, Israel has fled before the Philistines, and there's been a great slaughter among the people. Also, your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead, and the ark of God has been captured. Bad news. And when he hears this news, he's sitting in his chair and he falls back. And verse 18 says that his neck was broken and he died. Had judged Israel for 40 years. And this is how his judgeship comes to an end. Rather inglorious, don't you think? We're told in verses 19 through 21 that Phinehas' wife hears what has happened, and she is with child. And in her agony, she goes into labor and she delivers that child. And the stress is so great on her that she dies after delivering that child. But before she dies, she names her son, and she names him Ichabod. No glory. There's no glory today. I've had a child, and that was supposed to be the most glorious thing, really, that a Hebrew woman could do, was to bring, especially a man child, into the world. There's no glory here. Why not? Because Israel has been defeated, and my husband is dead. And the high priest of Israel is dead. And the Ark of the Covenant of God is captured. The true presence of God is the true glory of a people. When God is with them, they are glorious. When God is not with them, there is no glory. and the glory of God, the presence of God, leaves God's people because of their sin. I've known only one other person named Ichabod, and that was in that work of fiction. But maybe there ought to be a lot of people named Ichabod. You ever thought about that? You ever heard of anybody else named Ichabod? Carrie, when I was walking down the aisle here, he had seen what was going to be the sermon night. He said, you know, I've never heard of anybody name their child Ichabod other than this gal and I guess Miss Crane in that work of fiction. I had never heard of anybody naming their child Ichabod either. But I tell you, there'll be a lot of people named Ichabod. Because a lot of people in this world don't have the presence of God in their life. Therefore, there is no glory. I don't care whatever else they have accomplished, there is no glory in their life. When they're living in sin, there is no glory. A lot of churches, it probably need to be named the Ichabod Church. Because long ago, even though they have all of the symbols, all of the appearance of God in their presence, and they sing about God in their presence, and it looks like God is in their presence, the fact of the matter is, God left a long time ago. And He left because of their disobedience. He left because of their sin. Perhaps there ought to be quite a few Ichabod Churches of Christ. But what about you? What about this church? Should it be named the Ichabod Church of Christ? Are we determined that we'll never have that name on us, the no glory Church of Christ? I'll tell you how we'll keep that from happening. We'll keep it from happening by being faithful to the Lord. To the things that the Lord has demanded that we be, and the things that the Lord has demanded that we do. And what about you? Would it be better to name you Ichabod? I hope not. And I hope that you are constantly taking inventory of your life to see if the presence of God is there with you. Whoever abides in the doctrine of Christ has both the Father and the Son. There's how you have the glory of God, the presence of God with you, by abiding in the teaching of Christ. Let's all commit ourselves to being people who are in the presence of God and God in our presence, giving us victory in our personal lives and giving us unified as a congregation His glory and His presence. And that's our sermon for this evening. I hope it'll be of benefit to you as you consider your life and as we consider together the life of this church. Perhaps there's someone in the audience this evening who kind of finds themselves in the situation that Israel found themselves. You're doing battle and you're losing. You're doing battle with life and you're losing the battle. Can I tell you what you need to do to get victorious? You need to get the presence of God in your life. And you do that by being obedient to the gospel of Jesus Christ, by believing that Jesus is the Son of God, repenting of your sins, being baptized to have your sins washed away in His precious blood, and then living faithfully to Him until you come to the end of this life. Do you need to do that tonight? Do you need our help in accomplishing that? If you do, why not let us know by coming forward right now, while together we stand and sing.